Parson's Pleasure, read by Geoffrey Palmer.
Mr. Boggess was driving the car slowly, leaning back comfortably in the seat with one elbow resting on the sill of the open window. "How beautiful the countryside is," he thought. "How pleasant to see a sign or two of summer once again." The best thing now, he told himself, would be to make for the top of Brill Hill. He could see it about 1/2 mile ahead. And that must be the village of Brill, that cluster of cottages among the trees right on the very summit. He drove up the hill and stopped the car just short of the summit on the outskirts of the village. Then he got out and looked around. He could see for miles. It was perfect. He could see one medium farmhouse over on the right, with a track leading to it from the road. There was another larger one beyond it. There was a house surrounded by tall elms that looked as though it might be Queen Anne, and there were two likely farms away over on the left. Mr. Boggess drew a rough sketch on his pad showing the position of each, so that he'd be able to find them easily when he was down below. Apart from the fact that he was at this moment disguised in the uniform of a clergyman, there was nothing very sinister about Mr. Cyril Boggess. By trade, he was a dealer in antique furniture, with his own shop and showroom in the King's Road, Chelsea. His premises were not large, and generally he didn't do a great deal of business. But because he always bought cheap, very, very cheap, and sold very, very dear, he managed to make quite a tidy little income. During the past few years, Mr. Boggess had achieved considerable fame among his friends in the trade by his ability to produce unusual and often quite rare items with astonishing regularity. Whenever they asked him where he got the stuff, he would smile knowingly and wink and murmur something about a little secret. The idea behind Mr. Boggess's little secret was a simple one, and it had come to him as a result of something that had happened on a certain Sunday afternoon nearly 9 years before, while he was driving in the country. The fan belt of his car had broken, causing the engine to overheat and the water to boil away. He'd walked to the nearest house, a smallish farm building, and had asked the woman who answered the door for a jug of water. While he was waiting for her to fetch it, he spotted a large oak armchair of a type that he had only seen once before in his life. Each arm, as well as the panel at the back, was supported by a row of 8 beautifully turned spindles. The back panel itself was decorated by an inlay of the most delicate floral design. "Good God," he thought, "this thing is late 15th century. And there, by heavens, was another of them on the other side of the fireplace. 2 chairs like that must be worth at least £1,000 up in London, and, oh, what beauties they were!" When the woman returned, Mr. Boggess introduced himself straight away and asked if she would like to sell her chairs. "Oh, dear me," she said, "they were definitely not for sale. But just out of curiosity, how much would he give?" "Or £35? £35. She'd always thought they were valuable. They were very old. They were very comfortable, too. She couldn't possibly do without them. "Well, they weren't really so very old," Mr. Boggess told her. "And they wouldn't be at all easy to sell, but it just happened that he had a client who rather liked that sort of thing. Maybe he could go up another £2. They bargained for 1/2 an hour, and of course in the end Mr. Boggess got the chairs for something less than 1/20th of their value. That evening, Mr. Boggess had suddenly been struck by what seemed to him to be a most remarkable idea. If there is good stuff in one farmhouse, then why not in others? Why shouldn't he search for it? Why shouldn't he comb the countryside? He could do it on Sundays. It was the comparatively isolated places, the large farmhouses and the rather dilapidated country mansions, that he was looking for. But country folk are a suspicious lot, and so are the impoverished rich. You can't go about expecting them to show you around their houses just for the asking, because they won't do it. How, then, was he to gain admittance? perhaps it would be best if he didn't let them know he was a dealer at all. He could be the telephone man, the plumber, the gas inspector. He could even be a clergyman. From this point on, the whole scheme began to take on a more practical aspect. Mr. Boggis ordered a large quantity of superior cards on which was engraved, "The Reverend Cyril Winnington Boggis, President of the Society for the Preservation of Rare Furniture, in association with the Victoria and Albert Museum." Every Sunday, he was going to be a nice old parson travelling around compiling an inventory of the treasures that lay hidden in the country homes of England. Now, it was another Sunday, and as Mr. Boggis drove down the hill, headed for his first house, the Queen Anne, he began to get the feeling that this was going to be one of his lucky days. He parked the car and got out to walk the rest of the way. He never liked people to see the car until after the deal was completed. A dear old clergyman and a large station wagon somehow never seemed quite right together. Mr. Boggis approached the front door and rang the bell. He heard the sound of footsteps in the hall, and the door opened, and suddenly there stood a gigantic woman dressed in riding breeches. "Yes?" she asked, looking at him suspiciously. "What is it you want?" Mr. Boggis raised his hat and handed her his card and explained about the Society for the Preservation of Rare Furniture. "This wouldn't by any chance be something to do with the Socialist Party?" she asked. From then on, it was easy. A Tory in riding breeches, male or female, was always a sitting duck for Mr. Boggis. He spent 2 minutes delivering an impassioned eulogy on the extreme right wing of the Conservative Party, then two more denouncing the Socialists. As a clincher, he made particular reference to the bill that the Socialists had once introduced for the abolition of blood sports in the country, and went on to inform his listener that his idea of heaven, though you better not tell the bishop, my dear, was a place where one could hunt the fox, the stag, and the hare with large packs of tireless hounds from morn till night every day of the week, including Sundays. The woman let out a great guffaw of laughter. "Come in!" she shouted. "I don't know what the hell you want, but come on in." Unfortunately, and rather surprisingly, there was nothing of any value in the whole house, and Mr. Boggis, who never wasted time on barren territory, soon made his excuses and took his leave. From now on, it was all farmhouses, and the nearest was situated somewhere back in the fields. In order to keep his car out of sight, Mr. Boggis had to leave it on the road and walk about 600 yards along a straight track that led directly into the backyard of the farmhouse. There were three men standing in a close group in a corner of the yard, and when they caught sight of Mr. Boggis walking forward in his black suit and parson's collar, they stopped talking, and three faces turned towards him, watching him suspiciously as he approached. The oldest of the three was a stumpy man with small shifty eyes, and although Mr. Boggis didn't know it, his name was Rummins, and he was the owner of the farm. The tall youth beside him was Bert, the son of Rummins. The shortish, fat-faced man was Claude. Claude had dropped in on Rummins in the hope of getting a piece of pork or ham out of him from the pig that had been killed the day before. Claude knew about the killing. The noise of it had carried far across the fields, and he also knew that a man should have a government permit to do that sort of thing, and that Rummins didn't have one.
"Good afternoon," Mr. Boggis said. "Isn't it a lovely day?"
None of the three men moved. At that moment, they were all thinking precisely the same thing, that somehow or other, this clergyman, who was certainly not the local fella, had been sent to poke his nose into their business and to report what he found to the government.
"Might I inquire if you are the owner?" Mr. Boggis asked, addressing himself to Rummins.
"What is it you want?"
Mr. Boggis offered his card.
I just want to look at the furniture to see if you happen to have any treasures, and then I can write about them in our society magazine.
"You know what I think,"
Rummins said, fixing him with his small wicked eyes.
"I think you're after buying the stuff yourself."
"Oh, dear me, I only wish I had the money. Of course, If I saw something that I took a great fancy to, and it wasn't beyond my means, I might be tempted to make an offer, but alas, that rarely happens.
Well, Rummins said, I don't suppose there's any harm in your taking a look around, if that's all you want.
They went through the kitchen, where the only furniture was a cheap deal table with a dead chicken lying on it, and they emerged into a fairly large, exceedingly filthy living room. And there it was. Mr. Boggess saw it at once, and he stopped, dead in his tracks, and gave a gasp of shock. Then he stood there, staring like an idiot. At this point, Mr. Boggess became aware of the three men, Rummins, Bert, and Claude, standing together in a group over by the fireplace, watching him intently. In a flash, Mr. Boggess clapped one hand over his heart, staggered to the nearest chair, and collapsed into it, breathing heavily.
"What's the matter with you?" Claude asked.
"It's nothing," he gasped. "I'll be all right in a minute. Please, a glass of water?"
Bert fetched him the water. "I thought maybe you were looking at something," Rummins said.
"No, no," Mr. Boggess said. "It's just my heart. It happens every now and then."
He must have time to think, he told himself. He was holding one hand over his eyes in a gesture of pain, and now very carefully, secretly, he made a little crack between two of the fingers and peeked through. What he saw was a piece of furniture that any expert would have given almost anything to acquire. Mr. Boggess knew, as does every other dealer in Europe and America, that among the most celebrated and coveted examples of 18th-century English furniture in existence are the three famous pieces known as the Chippendale Commodes. The last one to be sold had fetched 3,900 guineas. And that was in 1921. Today the same piece would surely be worth £10,000. All the experts were agreed that these three commodes could have been executed only by Thomas Chippendale himself. And here, Mr. Boggess kept telling himself, here was the fourth Chippendale commode, and he had found it. He would be rich. He would also be famous. Each of the other three was known through the furniture world by a special name, the Chastleton Commode, the first Raynham Commode, the second Raynham Commode. This one would go down in history as the Boggess Commode. It was a most impressive, handsome affair, built in the French Rococo style of Chippendale's Directoire period, a kind of large, fat chest of drawers set upon four carved and fluted legs that raised it about a foot from the ground.
"How are you feeling now?"
Mr. Boggess heard someone say.
Thank you. I'm much better already."
A trifle unsteadily, he began to move around the room, examining the furniture, one piece at a time, commenting upon it briefly. He could see that apart from the commode, it was a very poor lot.
"Now, this chest of drawers," he walked casually past the Chippendale commode and gave it a little contemptuous flip with his fingers. "Worth a few pounds, I dare say, but no more. Rather crude reproduction, I'm afraid, probably made in Victorian times. Did you paint it white?"
"Yes," Rummins said. "Bert did it. A very wise move. It's considerably less offensive in white."
"Oh, that's a strong piece of furniture," Rummins said. "Some nice carving on it, too."
"Machine carved," Mr. Boggess answered superbly, bending down to examine the exquisite craftsmanship. "You can tell it a mile off."
He began to saunter off. Then he checked himself and turned slowly back again.
"You know what?" he said, looking at the commode, speaking so casually that his voice kept trailing off. "I've just remembered. I've been wanting a set of legs, something like that, for a long time."
He paused.
"Now, I was thinking,
These legs on your chest of drawers might be very suitable. They could easily be cut off and fixed onto my coffee table.
He looked around and saw the three men standing absolutely still, watching him suspiciously.
Mr. Boggy shook his head. What on earth am I saying? I'm talking as though I owned the piece myself. I do apologize.
What you mean to say is you'd like to buy it,
Rummins said.
Well, Mr. Boggis glanced back at the commode, frowning. I'm not sure. No, I think it might be a bit too much trouble.
How much were you thinking of offering?
Rummins asked.
Well, not much, I'm afraid. You see, this is not a genuine antique. It's merely a reproduction.
Oh, I'm not so sure about that,
Rummins told him. It's been here over 20 years, and before that it was up at the manor house. I bought it there myself at auction when the old squire died. You can't tell me that the thing's new.
Well, it's not exactly new, but it's certainly not more than about 60 years old.
It's more than that, Rummins said.
Bert, where's that bit of paper you once found at the back of one of them drawers? That old bill?
The boy looked vacantly at his father.
It was in the back of that drawer underneath all them rabbit snares, Rummins was saying.
Bert went forward to the commode.
You mean this?
He lifted out a piece of folded yellowing paper and carried it over to the father, who unfolded it and held it up close to his face.
You can't tell me this writing ain't bloody old,
Rummins said. And he held the paper out to Mr. Boggis, whose whole arm was shaking when he took it. The writing was in a long, sloping, copperplate hand. Edward Montague, Esquire, debtor to Thomas Chippendale. A large mahogany commode table of exceeding fine wood, very rich carved, set upon fluted legs, the whole completely finished in the most exquisite taste, £87.
Oh, God, it was wonderful. With the invoice, the value had climbed even higher.
He tossed the paper contemptuously onto the table and said quietly,
"That's exactly what I told you.
A Victorian reproduction. This is simply the invoice that the seller, the man who made it and passed it off as an antique, gave to his client. I've seen lots of them. Now, you'll notice that he doesn't say he made it himself. That would give the game away.
Say what you like, Rummins announced. That's an old piece of paper.
Of course it is, dear friend. It's Victorian. Late Victorian. Oh, that was a time when masses of cabinet makers did nothing else but apply themselves to faking the fine furniture of the century before.
Listen, parson, Rummins said. How on earth can you be so sure it's a fake, when you haven't even seen what it looks like underneath all that paint?
Well, come over here, and I'll show you. Now, anyone got a knife?
Claude produced a horn-handled pocket knife, and Mr. Boggis opened the smallest blade. Then, working with apparent casualness, but actually with extreme care, he began chipping off the white paint from a very small area on top of the commode. The paint flaked away cleanly from the old hard varnish underneath, and when he'd cleared away about 3 square inches, he stepped back and said,
"Now, take a look at that."
It was beautiful, a warm little patch of mahogany glowing like a topaz, rich and dark with the true colour of its 200 years.
"What's wrong with it?"
Rummins asked.
"It's processed. Anyone can see that."
"How can you see it, mister? You tell us."
"Well, I must say that's a trifle difficult to explain. It's chiefly a matter of experience. Well, my experience tells me that without the slightest doubt, this wood has been processed with lime. That's what they use for mahogany, to give it that dark, aged colour."
Mr. Boggis bent down and pointed to one of the metal drawer handles on the commode.
"Now, this is another place where the fakers go to work," he said. "Old brass normally has colour and character all of its own. Did you know that?"
But the trouble is that they've become exceedingly skilled at matching it. In fact, it's almost impossible to tell the difference between genuine old and faked old. I don't mind admitting that it has me guessing.
All right, Rummins said. So you admit you can't tell about the handles, hmm? For all you know, they may be hundreds of years old, correct?
Ah, Mr. Boggess whispered. That's where you're wrong. Watch this.
From his jacket pocket, he took out a small screwdriver. At the same time, although none of them saw him do it, he also took out a little brass screw, which he kept well hidden in the palm of his hand. Then he selected one of the screws in the commode and started slowly to unscrew it.
If this is a genuine old brass screw from the 18th century, he was saying, you'll be able to see quite easily that it has been hand-cut with a file.
It was not difficult, as he put his hands over the old screw and drew it out, for Mr. Boggess to substitute the new one hidden in his palm.
There you are, he said, handing the modern screw to Rummins. Take a look at that. Notice the exact evenness of the spiral? Ah, it's just a cheap, common little machine-made screw you yourself could buy today in any ironmongers in the country.
The screw was handed round from one to the other, each examining it carefully. Even Rummins was impressed now. Mr. Boggess put the screwdriver back in his pocket together with the fine hand-cut screw that he'd taken from the commode, and then he turned and walked slowly past the three men towards the door. Rummins glanced up from examining the screw.
You didn't tell us what you were going to offer, he said.
Mr. Boggess looked across at the commode and gave a little scornful wave of the hand.
Oh, shall we say, 10 pounds? I think that would be fair.
10 pounds? Rummins cried.
Oh, it's worth more than that for the firewood, Claude said, disgusted. Look here at the bill, Rummins went on. It'll tell you exactly what it cost, £87, and that's when it was new. Now it's antique, it's worth double.
If you'll pardon me, no, sir, it's not. It's a second-hand reproduction. But I'll tell you what, my friend, I'm being rather reckless. I'll go as high as £15. Make it 50,
Rummins said. A delicious little quiver like needles ran all the way down the back of Mr. Boggess's legs. He had it now. It was his. But the habit of buying cheap, acquired by years of practice, was too strong in him to permit him to give in so easily.
"My dear man," he whispered softly, "I only want the legs. The rest of it, as your friend so rightly said, is firewood. That's all. I'll make you one final offer, £20."
I'll take it, Rummins snapped. It's yours.
Oh, dear, Mr. Boggess said. There I go again. I should never have started this in the first place.
You can't back out now, Parson. A deal's a deal. How are you going to take it?
Well, let me see. Perhaps if I were to drive my car up into the yard, you gentlemen would be kind enough to help me load it.
In a car? This thing will never go in a car. You need a truck for this.
No, I don't think so. Anyway, we'll see. My car's on the road. I'll be back in a jiffy. We'll manage it somehow, I'm sure.
Mr. Boggess walked out into the yard and through the gate, and then along the track that led across the field towards the road. He found himself giggling quite uncontrollably. Back in the farmhouse, Rummins was saying, "Fancy that old bastard giving £20 for a load of junk like this."
"What if it won't go in the car?" Claude asked. "Then he's going to say to hell with it and just drive off without it and you'll never see him again. Nor the money either. He didn't seem that keen on having it, you know."
Rummins paused to consider this new and rather alarming prospect. Claude went on relentlessly.
"Parson never had a big car anyway. No, I've got an idea. He told us that it was only the legs he was wanting, right? So all we've got to do is cut them off before he comes back. Then it'll be sure to go in the car.
Well, it's not such a bad idea at that, Rummin said, looking at the commode. Come on, then. We'll have to hurry. You and Bert carried out into the yard. I'll get the saw.
Within a couple of minutes, Claude and Bert had carried the commode outside and had laid it upside down in the yard. Rummins came over from the shed carrying a long saw. Claude took the saw away from him and went to work.
Cut them close, Rummins said. Don't forget, he's going to use them on another table.
The mahogany was hard and very dry, and as Claude worked, a fine red dust sprayed out from the edge of the saw. One by one, the legs came off, and Bert stooped down and arranged them carefully in a row.
Claude stepped back to survey the results of his labour.
There was a longish pause.
"Just let me ask you one question, Mr. Rummins," he said. "Even now, could you put that enormous thing into the back of a car?"
"Not unless it was a van."
"Correct," Claude cried. "And Parsons don't have vans. All they've got usually is piddling little Morris 8s or Austin 7s. "Well, the legs is all he wants," Rummins said. "If the rest of it won't go in, then he can leave it. He can't complain."
"Now, you know better than that, Mr. Rummins," Claude said patiently. "You know damn well he's going to start knocking the price if he don't get every single bit of this into his car, so why don't we give him his firewood now and be done with it? Where do you keep the axe?"
"I reckon that's fair enough," Rummins said. "Bert, go and fetch the axe."
Bert went into the shed and fetched a tall woodcutter's axe and gave it to Claude. Claude spat on the palms of his hands and rubbed them together. Then, with a long-armed, high-swinging action, he began fiercely attacking the legless carcass of the commode.
It was hard work, and it took several minutes before he had the whole thing more or less smashed to pieces.
"I'll tell you one thing," Claude said, straightening up, wiping his brow. "That was a bloody good carpenter put this job together, and I don't care what the parson says."
"We're just in time," Rummins called out.
"Here he comes!"